Texas in rolling blackouts. What's the message for the market? Reddit Rebel, deep effing value on the Hill. Why should we care? And Treasury selling off. Are they headed to 150? All that and a lot more coming right up with Tyler Neville. Tyler, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Ed. Always good to be here.
So two things. One is I know that you have a new newsletter that you write, and I know that you're in Texas where they have the rolling blackout. So let's start with those two things. Tell me about the newsletter and then tell me what's going on down there.
Yeah, so basically the newsletter is just everything macro and crypto combined. So we're seeing a lot of those two worlds combine. And what we want to do is kind of teach the legacy macro world about crypto and vice versa, right? Because a lot of the things kind of react to the same factors. So that's first off. Second off, living in Austin in this frozen tundra is just a real surreal experience. Compared to any other part of the country I've lived in, when I lived in Boston, you take for granted all the infrastructure you have for, like, you know, snow plows, shoveling, salt. And down here, there's not one of those for 2,000 miles. So everything stops. Like, grocery stores were closed. You can't get on the roads. You can't, like, go anywhere. The entire, like, pavement outside is just a sheet of ice, to the point where, like, I can't even walk outside with my kids. So that is why we're seeing a lot of the supply chain disruptions in stuff like oil right now.
Yeah. And, you know, I want to get to that. But do you think that this whole phenomenon is, I mean, they never get this kind of weather anyway. Do you think that it's a bad planning on Texas's part? Everyone's really talking about it from the perspective of how could they be so vulnerable? In Alaska, they have a power grid that works. You know, in Massachusetts, obviously, they have one that works too.
Yeah, this is like a tail risk thing. I don't think you can blame the politicians or any of the infrastructure things. Like, my house wasn't built for cold weather. Like, in the Northeast, your house is built for cold weather where your pipes don't freeze. There's an external pipe system for the outside and an internal one. Here, we don't have that. The insulation is completely different. So, you know, a lot of that stuff is just like, it's basically a tropical, you know, weather here all the time. So it's the coldest weather since, I think, 1989. So how do you protect for tail risk is, like, you're going to lose money every single year trying to do that as a politician. It's not going to be economical. So I think everyone's just kind of doing the best they can, helping each other and, you know, getting through this time.
So you pointed out the markets. I mean, commodity markets, oil markets, all of them are going up. But what's the message for the markets about what's going on down there?
I think it's interesting. Like, the Permian, I think, lost 3 million barrels a day. And if you look at, like, U.S. oil production, it just went from, say, 13 million barrels a day to 7.5 barrels per day, which is obviously causing, like, a little supply shock here in the U.S. But the follow-on is that leads to higher inflation, and which is probably why you're seeing treasury yields rise, along with the increased supply because of the deficit blowing out. So it's kind of a funny daisy chain of events that's pretty concerning, I'd say. And also, it might lead to basically a bigger secular change in inflation here.
Right. Yeah. And we're going to get into the whole treasury part of the thing. But, you know, there, when you talk about daisy chains, I was thinking about a chart that you showed me with U.S. equities and commodities. It almost looks like they're going up together. What's going on with that chart?
Well, this is the lumber chart, and that's the lumber and the home builder ETF. So lumber obviously, like, is skyrocketing. The home supply is at record lows. Mortgage rates are at, like, record lows. So you have a lot of equity built up in your house as mortgage rates fall, and you also have this dearth of supply in lumber. So home builders are kind of making out, but this is all more inflationary pressure coming along with the oil shock here. So what
about the correlation between U.S. equities and lumber? I mean, they seem like they're going up at the same time.
Yeah, I think that's happening basically because the Fed is adding massive liquidity to the market. But there are some divergences there that are the rumblings below the surface. As treasury yields rise, I think we are getting into this weird part of the market where it could cause like a tumble in the fixed income market right here. But we'll talk about that in a few.
Right, definitely. So one thing you were talking about is you said U.S. production went from like 13 mil to 7 mil a day. It used to be that the Saudis were the swing producer. Now everyone's talking about the U.S. being the swing producer. What does that mean just from just a macro perspective now that you have these shale guys basically as the ones that are the toggle for the global supply chains and obviously American supply chains?
Yeah, I'm not an energy specialist by any means, but it's definitely a weird divergence to see there. And, you know, one of the weird things I haven't really wrapped my head around is as the price of oil rises here and U.S. yields rise, and theoretically high yields should rise as well. But a lot of those high yield companies are now oil suppliers, so they might get more debt issuance in this backdrop as oil actually rises. So we could see, you know, production rise again and then oil roll over commensurately. But cool, that's a wait and see game.
Yeah, that is interesting. I mean, for me, the biggest nexus here between what's happening in the oil market is between, you know, the rolling blackouts to oil, then to interest rates that you're talking about. You already talked about treasuries, inflation. You talked about high yield versus treasuries, all of that mix. Why don't we get to that? Because, I mean, the backdrop is that we were at 90 basis points early January. Now we're at like 130 basis points on the 10-year. A lot of people are talking about the break-evens going way up for tips. And the question is how much further can these things go up? What's behind it? What are you seeing? What's the macro picture that you're painting of what's happening right now?
Yeah, so one of the brilliant charts that I saw on Twitter from this one guy, I give you credit, I forgot your name, but it juxtaposes the high yield implied vol versus the TLT implied vol. And if you look at this chart, it's 1 month implied vol, and you're seeing that TLT is now popping a little bit, the volatility, which means rates are rising, right? And the ratio between the two shows, that's the bottom half of the chart, that shows that high yield is still bid up, meaning high yield rates are still pretty low, which we all know that story. And Jack owes me for calling that the yields keep going lower. But now we're seeing the implied vol of treasuries rise. And I think it's a delayed reaction in the high yield market where they'll probably rise soon commensurately because we're already at pretty much lows between those two ratios.
Yeah. And I mean, if we have rates in the U.S. treasuries rising, say treasuries now maybe going up to the top of the range between 1 and 150, up to 150, spreads are incredibly low, which is why they were going down to begin with for the rates in the high yield. You would think that actually spreads would reverse. So it's a double whammy. Not only are treasury yields going up, but then spreads are widening together as well.
Yeah, I mean, spreads have really gotten super tight. And theoretically, you'd think, you know, with the illiquidity of high yield in general, those will start blowing out here a little bit. And I think that's why you're seeing some de-risking in, you know, the growth names in the equity market is people are paying attention to it. But the demand is still there. You know, the pensions are still massively unfunded. These deals are getting like, you know, majorly oversubscribed in the high yield market, which shows like they're still trying to make up that gap. But there are rumblings like, you know, their real rates are no longer falling anymore. It's becoming less negative, which is a concern that deflation might be arising again. And commensurately, the Fed will have to step in at some point. My guess is they will, and they'll probably institute yield curve control, and then we'll have, you know, negative real rates ad infinitum, like Luke Groman talks about.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that was my next question for you about, well, how this unraveled. I mean, because basically the way I'm looking at it is there was a quote that I came across that from 2007 that people remember, you know, I think it was Chuck Prince, who's the CEO of Citigroup. He was saying, you know, while the music's playing, you got to dance. And we're still dancing. And they hauled him in front of Congress. And they were like, what are you talking about? Why are you saying stuff like that? I mean, that's so ridiculous. And he was saying, wait a minute, hold on. The reason I said that is because the regulators, I was talking about the leveraged loan market, and the rates were out of control. And, you know, it's not for me. We have to dance. We have to actually, you know, play in that market as a bank if we want to, you know, be in that market. It's for you, the regulators, to make things happen. And it seems like we're back there again, 13 years later, that's where we are with those yields so incredibly low.
Yeah, and it's, I think the imbalances are way bigger this time, which is super scary. And one of the things I want to mention, and I wrote in my note tonight, which is, I think Bitcoin is actually sniffing out the Fed yield curve control before anything else. Like, we saw just the past month, Tesla has fallen 5% and Bitcoin's gone up, I think, something like 40% just in the past month. And they might even be front running. Like, the crypto market is essentially super macro market, right? They're super risk forward, but they pay attention to all the macro stuff. And crypto is really kind of front running all this stuff at this point. And if they know that yield curve control is coming, you're going to see that massive rotation into those highly inflationary assets.
And so how far, I mean, because when we think about real interest rates being negative, basically that's the Fed, you know, stomping on the market and saying, look, you know, we want to make it easy for debtors. How far are they willing to let real interest rates rise? Is the question how far they're willing to let it rise? Or is the question what needs to break in markets before the Fed intervenes?
Yeah, I think it's probably the real rates question, because if they actually, like, you can have a real bad cascading effect with how much money is in passive investment at this point. And the equity market could theoretically even go no bid. That's how bad the imbalances are. So, like, I'd imagine they step in. Although what's funny is that Powell remains so adamant about, you know, his mission, but there's rumblings internally about, you know, for other Fed members that, hey, we're creating some major problems here, but I think it's too late. Like, it's already Ponzi finance.
Yeah. And, you know, when you talk about you were talking about the float and passive, I was thinking to myself about the last story that's on our radar for today, which is GameStop, you know, so Deep Effing Value, AKA Roaring Kitty, he was in front of Congress. You know, he's being sued in some other venues, et cetera. The story that people are talking about is one of, you know, how could you put it, David and Goliath kind of thing. I mean, how do you break apart this story in sort of a macro context?
My macro context is, it's so funny watching this because they are all, you know, self-aggrandizing and virtue signaling about how they are doing the greatest thing for market structure, which is half true. Like, you know, it's like taking an antibiotic. They've closed spreads. They've made them really, really small. But they didn't mention once about Vanguard or BlackRock and how that's incentivized them to lower fees to scale even more. And what happens, speaking of side effects, when you scale passive investment is due diligence of stocks goes out the door and you start allocating money based off models instead of like business decisions and fundamentals. And we're already way past that. You know, like hedge funds are getting taken to the cleaners. The long short model is basically toast if Jay Powell just keeps putting the pedal to the metal. Like, how do you short anything in this setting? So my point being is this whole charade on Capitol Hill is just people pointing fingers, trying to find the problem, but the problem is not even there. It's his name is Mortimer Buckley, and he's the CEO of Vanguard, and no one even knows the guy's name. That's how funny it is. And they can strip the float, and then
I was thinking Trading Places when you said Mortimer.
Yeah, Tim Buckley is the guy's name. But like, it's hilarious that, you know, you get Ken Griffin. Everyone knows Ken Griffin, you know, but no one knows the CEO of Vanguard. It's a hilarious, you know, situation. But what happens is they can constrict the float. And then if you're short as a long short fund, it takes less and less stock to move it. So that's what, you know, deep effing value figured out. Buying long out of the money call options, and it's a market structure thing. Here's the other thing that the long short hedge funds have a real problem with is portfolio managers are starting to understand liquidity a little bit better, but like say a stock trades 1 million shares a day, you should just immediately take that 1 million shares that trades and just X out half of it. Cause that's 500,000 shares you can't even access cause that's high frequency, just flipping it back and forth, right? So you really have 500,000 shares to deal with. So if you have a high short interest, a low float, and the liquidity at the microstructure level is that small, and you wouldn't know this as a retail investor because you'll buy and sell 100 shares. But if you have to buy and sell 1 million shares, that's where the Melvin Capitals of the world get absolutely like annihilated because it's annihilating short sellers. It's annihilating long short funds. And who's the winner in all this? The Vanguards and the BlackRocks of the world.
Very interesting. Hey, let me see if I can pick this apart because I think this is an important point. So basically you're saying we're talking David and Goliath on Capitol Hill and people, but really, actually, that's not what this is all about. This is all about market structure on some level. That first and foremost, floats as it is anyway, are lower than they used to be to begin with. Second, you add in high frequency trading on top of that, you're cutting that float in half. Third, you know, many of the flows are from passive investing, guys who are not even doing due diligence because, you know, they're getting the money in, they got it allocated to the shares within the index that they're passively tied to. So then that's the situation that deep effing value comes into. And he's able to game the system based upon that. But guys like Melvin Capital, who have tons of money, how are they supposed to actually make any money unless they leverage up into risky situations like this, where they're so big that they risk not being able to exit their position very easily? I mean, that's why they got a 50% loss, because they were so big relative to the float.
Yeah. And their problem probably wouldn't have existed if it was actually active managers as holders, because what happens in that the passive thing, Mike Green and Carson Block talk about it all the time, is passive won't sell until it has an outflow. So just take all that, you know, Fidelity, BlackRock, and Vanguard who held it. You know, they just are holding it over here, and you're trading a smaller and smaller piece of the outstanding value of the company. So price is a liar. Price is an equilibrium of liquidity, right? Like the old John Burbick saying. And they just skyrocketed up. But I think that happens at the end of cycles, is there's winners and there's losers. And the winners never stop themselves. They have to grow ad infinitum, like forever. That's like the whole ego thing is like, I need to grow. And at some point, I think we're past the state of like trying to unwind this. Because all the active managers are, who's going to step in front of passive outflows if they ever come? You know, it's indiscriminate selling.
Right.
And you're annihilating, like, look, Andrew Left just tapped out of short selling. That is a sign to me that like something, well, this guy was one of the best in the business for a lot of years and now he can't short anything. But I think the real culprit, we're watching like the side effect on the Capitol Hill hearings right now. But the passive is the big elephant in the room. And as long as Jay Powell stands beside it, he's going to ruin free markets. Like he probably already has, in all honesty.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
So my question is how does this unravel if it does? I mean, because basically, I mean, what you're saying is that on the way up, passive is just throwing the money in there. That's bidding up the shares. It's indiscriminate. But then obviously when there's an air pocket and people start pulling their money out, then it's the exact same thing. There's no bid on the other side, especially because, you know, no one's going to be on that. No one's there anyway. People like the short sellers aren't there to buy up the shares anymore. We saw that play out to 30% down. But then the Fed stepped in. They said, you know, we'll buy corporate bonds. We'll buy high yield. Maybe next time they'll step in and say, hey, we'll buy equities as well. We'll buy ETFs.
Yeah, like Japan did, right? And if that happens, I think Bitcoin goes to, you know, a million, like Raoul says, because everyone at that point will be like, all right, cat's out of the bag. This is really a Ponzi scheme. And I'm just going to go over here and play in this little pocket of like, at least it's a little more equitable over here. I think that's really what's going on. And the crypto people know it. It's already a foregone conclusion in their mind. They still have to pay attention to see if there's a policy mistake, because if somehow that little contingent at the Fed tells Jay Powell, you're causing way too much inequality and the social ramifications are going to be so bad, you're better off tightening. I think that's what crypto people really have to be pay attention to. Because if those real rates rise, everything gets taken to the cleaners. And I just don't think they'll do that with unfunded pensions. Still, like, you know, they want to make this boom zoom to the moon and have SPAC fever go on forever. But, you know, you just incentivize sociopaths at that point. And I think that's the state we're at. Like when capital is so easy to come by, people make up stories. Look at this thing, Dan David from Wolfpack Research, EHANG, is a straight up fraud. And it went down like 70%. And the only reason that worked, that short worked, was because it was all actively held. So the short sellers are gonna just slowly go off and pick off all the active management pockets in the market. It's usually probably value stocks, and short those things. And that bubble of passive is going to grow bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger.
So one of the things that I was expecting you to talk about when we were thinking about GameStop was this whole intergenerational thing, because that was an undercurrent that you saw there. I didn't watch all the Capitol Hill stuff, so I don't know how much that was on display, but this whole sort of like, you know, not only is it the man that we're sticking it to, but there's this sense that, you know, boomers, they made out like bandits, and, you know, the millennials, they're getting stuck with the bag. Talk to me about that. How do you see that in the whole GameStop thing?
Yeah, there's a great chart, you know, I showed the other day, which was boomers own the majority of assets, right? It's no, and Gen Xers own like a tiny bit more, and then millennials own like nothing. And it's really the same thing on the microstructure level as it is on the macro level, where boomers have cornered the market in assets and leverage. And if rates rise, you know, that's when it all blows up. But what happens at the end of cycles, everyone's like, what happens when boomers sell? What happens when boomers sell? But wouldn't you expect a crazy euphoria when the float is this big? Like the incremental dollar causes an asymmetric 18 times move in market cap. You would think there was going to be a blow off top, and then retail would lever up and chase it, right? We're kind of seeing that now. And I never thought it would get to like a Weimar level, but now I'm like, yeah, we're getting there. Like it's kind of crazy when you look at the amount of debt, and the narrative has changed too. If you're reading all these articles, people now know, okay, K-shaped recovery, this is completely unfair. I don't know how we change this. And they just keep doing the same thing. And there's this underlying contingent of people, if you're paying attention, they're like, they now get why crypto is a thing. And if you even go dig deeper, there's this guy, Preston Pish, who said something mind-blowing. He's like, if you actually look at the interest rates you can get in crypto by essentially like arbing, buying spot and selling the futures, it's like an easy, riskless 15-20%. And he goes, what if that is actually the real market interest rate of where things should be at? And it's a really fascinating thought experiment, because the Fed has basically stomped out all risk here, but in this completely free market over here with finite supply and increasing demand, you can manufacture like real yield there. And I think that's just the giant arb. And who does it best? Michael Saylor. He issues debt to unfunded pensions at 0% rates, and then buys something with such finite supply that has a genuine yield with incremental dollars moving in. He's a 21st century bank issuing debt to unfunded pensions and buying something that's highly inflationary sensitive. I mean, that's brilliant. And I think a lot of people are going to tag onto this eventually. And this is where it actually undermines the US dollar at some point if people do this, you know, forever. But we'll see. This next decision by the Fed is the biggest decision ever. It really is.
Which one? Like what? Which meeting are you thinking about?
It's either like the next time they have a meeting. I don't know the exact date, but it's either yield curve control, and you just say, we're going to just make inflation happen and inflate away the debts, or you say, we have a free market. And I think they're not going to choose a free market. It's not a free market. Everybody, like, it's so obvious it's not a free market at this point. There's pockets of little capitalism happening, but, you know, for the most part, it's not a free market. So this next one will be, are we going to be China or are we going to be America? And I think they're going to choose China.
So no, you know, let me unpack this for one second. I'll play devil's advocate. So yeah. We went to war against the Nazis and the Japanese and the Italians, won, but there was a huge amount of debt associated with that. And then there was also the demobilization. The Fed, that's when they first came in and they did yield curve control. They said, that's it. You know, we're capping rates at that point. No one batted an eye back then. Everyone accepted it for what it was, and no bad things happened. We had the baby boom. That's when the baby boomers were born. Why can't we go back? Isn't it possible that that's the future for America? It's going back to another boom like we had then.
It's conceivable, and I think you have to incentivize the entrepreneurs and the real people, and you have, that's why I meant you have pockets of capitalism, because that's happening certain places, and there is real innovation. But on the whole, growth is stagnating, in my opinion. And that's why you see basically everyone is forced into, at the end of the cycle, the last growing things. And it creates those bubble-like, herd-like mentalities. But yeah, I think we could, you know, if the entrepreneurs are that good and the money flows to the venture guys, but we'll see. They got to come up with something pretty good. With you had the baby boom. Now we have the baby boomers are rolling over, right? So we'll see. That's the $1 trillion question.
Yeah, and it's literally the $1 trillion question, because that's what all the SPACs are all about. Basically, we'll see what they come up with. I'm not that hopeful either, so I'm with you there.
Yeah, I mean, there's great things happening, and then there's bad things happening. I take it with a grain of salt. I know we get extreme here on Real Vision because it's fun to think about, but you know, this next big Fed meeting is going to be a doozy. So look forward to it.
Well, good, Tyler. Thanks for putting those three issues in perspective. I hope that things get better down there in Texas for you, and appreciate you coming back on.
Appreciate it, Ed. Thanks. I didn't shower today, so that's why I got the backwards hat on. No water.
Good luck, man.
See you, Ed.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.